Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. Now, if you're a regular listener here, you'll know that every month I do a live show, MK3D, at the BFI South Bank in London. But since lockdown, those shows have moved online. If you want to check them out, go to YouTube and search for the BFI channel, or just search MK3D. Now, those shows tend to be guest-packed, but in video form, we only have an hour running time, so we have to cut our interviews down. A few weeks ago, we ran extended versions of my interviews with Shazia Mirza and Simon Pegg. But on this podcast, you're going to hear from the great Brian Cox, choosing a guilty pleasure. But let's start with Salvador Simo, director of Buñuel in The Labyrinth of the Turtles.
Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome to the show Salvador Simo. Salvador, where are we speaking to you from? Where are you?
Well, now, at this moment, I'm in Madrid. This is where I'm living now and also working. So, yeah, Madrid.
And how have things been for you during the recent months, during the coronavirus outbreak?
Well, it's been very busy because right now I'm working in a CG animated movie, commissioned feature film. It's a co-production between Spain and China. So when all this started, we sent everyone to work at home. And so we had, I don't know, maybe 50, 60 people working from home. So it was very intense. I mean, all these days were very intense, very long days. So for me, it was working more than ever. So I didn't have time to get bored or just to do things at home. It's even worse.
So presumably, I mean, animation and effects work, VFX work, that has managed to carry on during everything, because that's something that can be done in isolation.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays when we have the advantage of the technology of the Zoom and other technologies that allowed us to speak remotely and also to work remotely. I mean, if we had this maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, it would be more complicated. But yeah, we're lucky. So.
Now, Salvador, your film is now on BFI Player. It's an extraordinary movie about Buñuel's creation of an extraordinary movie. Tell us a little bit about the story and the graphic novel upon which the film is based.
Well, the graphic novel of Fermín Solís, it talks a little bit about that event that was filming Las Hurdes. But as it is a graphic novel, the timing, the way to tell the story, it's different. I mean, it's a different media, so it's a different story after all. I mean, the in the graphic novel, there is a moment where basically most of it, it's them talking and walking. So you cannot do this in a film. So when we got the graphic novel, Eligio and me, what we did is we read the graphic novel, and then we close it, we put it down, and we say, okay, now we have to start to work. And then we make our own story, I mean, based, of course, on some ideas that were there. But we make our own investigation. We talk with Ian Gibson, who is a great biographer of Buñuel, also with Carrière. We talk with many people that had met Buñuel. Even we had the great fortune to meet several times Juan Luis Buñuel, who was alive in that time. And he helped us a lot with many of his own life stories, and also about his father, and understanding the great and deep feeling that was between him and Ramon Acín, who was a dear friend. And so all of that kind of drive us to find out what was really the story. Yeah. Because, I mean, you can tell the story about, okay, Luis Buñuel is going to film Las Hurdes, but this movie, it's more about a friendship story. It talks about these two friends, Ramon Acín and Luis Buñuel. And for me, it was very surprising the kicking event that it's when Ramon Acín tell him they were at night, probably after a few wines, and he told him, no worry, if I win the lottery, I will pay you the documentary. And then a few months later, for real, that's a real story, he won the lottery. And he kept his word, and he gave him the money to make the film. And my first reaction, it was, well, nowadays, I don't know if many people will keep his word. But then a few seconds later, I thought, no, no, wait. We will be surprised of how many people actually will keep his word.
Yeah.
Because all of us, we know people around us that they will keep his word. And that is what represents a little bit Ramon Acín, no? The good people in the world. And he was called the good man, no? in Huesca, no? So at the end, he became not just a supporting character, he also became the protagonist of the movie. No?
There's a lovely detail when he rings to tell Buñuel that he's won the lottery and he's going to go through with funding the film. And Buñuel says, oh, I can't believe it. And he says, yes, well, my wife would never forgive me if I didn't. And it immediately cuts to his wife chasing him out of the house saying, why are you giving this money to Buñuel? Also, of course, it's such a strange project, the idea of Buñuel filming what was technically a documentary, although, as we all know, there's a great difference between Buñuel doing a documentary and anyone else doing a documentary. For people who haven't seen the Buñuel film, can you describe what that film is like? Because there's a famous British director who described it as the most disturbing movie he had ever seen.
Well, it's a way... I will say that in that moment, that documentary, it was a slap in the face to the people, to the audience. And I think right now, it's a way to see a film, a cineast, a film director, a creator, representing the reality to the audience. He actually thinks about the audience much more than we can realize. Because the way he edit, the way he worked the documentary is to create some feelings to the audience. And that's why it's so touching, because everything is really thought in that moment. No? So that the way, there is one moment that we see some peak kind of like bathing in a small river in the middle of the village. And then later on, we see some kids in a different cut drinking what it seems that is the same water that the pig was bathing. Of course, it was not the same water, but he tries to tell you the story. Mm-hmm. And for him, it was, at least here in Spain, it was called a liar, because what he was saying, oh, that's not true, he manipulate the reality. But actually what he did is a recreation of the reality. Is what there is a moment in the film that he says, is what I'm doing. I'm doing a recreation of the reality. This is like this. I mean, and it was like this. It was for real. We work over what he used as a script. He had a book that from Maurice Legendre. It was a French humanist who spent many years in Las Hurdes, and he made a thesis about 300, 400 pages, and we had this book. And what it tells in that book is even worse than what Buñuel did. But he tried to represent that space, that the daily life of all these people in 30 minutes. I mean, I always, when I talk about these things and people question his way of making a documentary, I always ask people, well, we sure all saw a documentary of National Geographic where we see the small mouse in the middle of the forest in the night with his small nut, and suddenly a snake comes and eats the mouse. So we as an audience, we imagine, okay, maybe the guy who's filming, he stood in the middle of the forest for weeks without moving, waiting that small mouse just passing in front of the camera catch this image. And then suddenly also there is a snake that it came this and it eats this mouse in front of the camera. Of course, that was not true. It was, everything was a stage, but that doesn't mean that it was not real. So that's what Buñuel did. He make it all of that in the most powerful way. He represent that reality and he made this film. And he tried to change the world with that film. And that was his intention, to show that at 300 kilometers from the capital of Spain, Madrid, there was this place where people were actually hunger and dying from uncountless sickness. So that's what he tried to denounce with that film.
Tell me about using the live action clips, because what happens is obviously we see, you know, in animation, we see the film crew arriving and then we see little flashes of what they're filming, which are the live action stuff that Buñuel filmed. Tell me about using that with the animation. Did you ever consider animating it, or had you always planned to use those clips?
Well, that was an early decision, I mean, that we did at the beginning with the producer, Manuel Cristobal, because we thought that we had this material, that it was gold, and it was no better way to represent what was happening than the same images that Buñuel recorded in 1932. So we tried to find a grammatic of the film in the way of using these images. So every time the characters that are filming this documentary, they look through the camera, we see the images that Buñuel recorded. So it's like when you have you want to show what the characters are looking at or what the characters are filming, then we saw it through the eyes of Buñuel. Except two times that is just through the eyes of Buñuel. So, but everything, it has a reason. It's like a grammatic, a poetry. So that in the way there is these images, sometimes it's through the camera, sometimes it's not. Because at the end, the camera isn't just a way of saying the eyes of Buñuel, but sometimes it's more direct than, and sometimes it's less. And that it's allowed us to play with it, to play with that. And also that it brings the film to the ground. It's almost like, okay, there is no question that that happened. If we had drawn these images, the audience would say, these guys, they just draw this thing and this is a fantasy movie. But we try to make a movie that it's real, it feels real. Even with all the art, all the technique of animation, everything was trying to be married with the story. It works with the story. The lines of the drawings are broken because the story is a tough story. The animation is not like the typical cartoony animation that we see. It's more naturalistic, giving time to the audience to connect with the characters. So everything was thought to work with these moments, and that we have the real images. And then that it leaves us space to go up with the movie to other places with the dreams and his imagination. And the story keeps real because it has a good anchor points that are these parts of the documentary of Buñuel.
One of the things that happens during that story is the tension between Buñuel and the good man, who says to him, look, you know, you're being cruel. The donkey is suffering. There's the stuff with the chicken, in which they want to show something, but they won't do it themselves. There is a lot of cruelty involved in what Buñuel is filming. Do you agree?
It was 1930, the beginning of the last, it's almost 100 years ago. The society, it was different. I mean, if you try to talk about animal rights in that time, no one is going to listen to you. No one, everywhere in the world, no one is going to consider even the animal rights. I mean, right now we evolve, but we should never forget where we come from. And that's why we try to do it without any kind of sweetener. So this is as it was. So it's cruel, yes, but that's what real. And that was also part of the culture of Buñuel. In one of his books, he says that actually it was real that his father brought him to see the dead body of the donkey in the forest, in the field. And then he was so impressed. He was impressed because the vultures, they came.
Yes.
And then when he was 22, he wanted to see the vultures again. So he took a gun, he killed a donkey, and he waited for the vultures, and the vultures didn't came. So for him, it was something a little bit deceiving. But later on, when he recorded Las Urdes, he read it that, and it's written in the book of Legendre, that actually the hives of bees, they were transported by these donkeys through the mountain to other villages to sell. And once in a while, it's true that the hives fall down, they broke up, and then all the bees come wild and they kill not just the donkey, they also kill the man so fortunately, Buñuel just made the story with the donkey, but he thought that for him it was necessary to show this cruelty, because that it was also was making react the audience. And that if you see all the movies of Buñuel, there is always something that kind of like make the audience react, the stand up of the chair. No? That's a little bit his style. No? So, and we wanted to keep that, to keep his a little bit his flair about the way he tells the stories. No?
There's a lot of harshness in the story, but the animation is really beautiful. I mean, when I was watching it, I was reminded, I'm sure you've been told this before, but I was reminded of watching Chico and Rita and the beauty of the way the characters move, the naturalism of it, the thing which... Tell me something about the animation style and what you, where you took inspiration from.
Well, I always take inspiration about on animation, live action, but for us, the way we wanted to make the animation was very naturalistic and very content. So we didn't want two characters to overact. Mm-hmm. All the opposite, to put the brakes on the animators and just keep the characters moving as less as possible. And then we had Manolo Galeana as animation director, who also was the animation director of Chico y Rita. And then we talk about how we can do this thing work, and how we can feel this animation different. And normally the animation, even Chico y Rita and all the classicals, you see that you have one drawing for maybe each frame or each two frames, and that is what the retinian persistence, it makes you feel the sweetness on the movement. But here we did it on threes and fours. That means that every drawing was three or four frames shot.
Yeah.
So that makes the motion a little bit more, a tiny bit of stagger. So it's almost like it's dirty, but it's what the story is telling you. The story is not a sweet story. It needs this kind of style, because also it works with the style of the art, because the style of the art, the characters are sometimes very stylized and they have contrast with the backgrounds. So we need that the characters, they have this way of moving that integrated everything.
When you watch the film with an audience, are you surprised by audience reactions to it? Because I started watching the movie and I know something about Buñuel, and at first it's very light and very funny. And then they start talking about the darkness of the project. And actually it's very interesting that there's this tension between the beauty of the animated images and the darkness of the story that is being told. And also the fact that we actually know what's going to happen to the central character, the good character. We know what fate he is going to meet. So there is this great thread of darkness underlying the whole thing. How do audiences react when you watch the film with them?
Well, I mean, it's always surprising, and I think it's the best part for me, it's the best prize always. I mean, when you see the film with the audience and you see them laugh when they have to laugh, and even sometimes where they don't have to, But that creates a reaction. Then later on, the audience is like, oh, I shouldn't have been laughing. So it's very interesting. And then later on, of course, the reaction on the dark events, it's more, it's driven to that. So it's more expected, no? But for me, I always tell the same story. I mean, Jorge Usón, who was the actor who put the voice of Buñuel, because we didn't record it, we acted them. And he was an incredible actor. But I think it was almost the third or the fourth time that I was seeing the movie with him. And the last time I saw him, he was sitting on my side and he was crying at the end. And I was saying, Jorge, but you know how it's going to end. He's like, I cannot avoid it. So it somehow takes you to a place that it taught you, because it's Ramon, because it's someone that didn't deserve that.
Do you think of the film as being political?
No, I don't think it's about being political or not. I mean, everyone can take his own conclusions. No? That is the facts. I mean, I don't try to judge why anything. When Buñuel acted the way he acted because he had some background that was making him react in a peculiar way. And there is sometimes in the film that we hate him and sometimes we love him. So about the what it could be, the political approach, I try to just be as cold as possible in the way that it doesn't disturb what is more important, that is the friendship story. I mean, for me, what I felt more touching and more, when I was thinking that, I was really emotional, is what Buñuel must be feeling on that moment, where he's forced to take away the name of his friend to release the film. So it's a decision that if his friend was there, he was going to tell him, please take him away, but the most important thing is the film. But for him, it was his friend that was killed just little before. So I don't know, I mean, what was going through his mind or his heart in that moment, but it must have been really, really strong feelings.
I mean, the reason I ask you is because there's a couple of scenes in the film. We see the audience reacting to Large Door and hating it. And we see, you know, we see him, Buñuel, watching the audience, watching the film. And we hear, you know, fascist, communist, we hear these terms thrown around, you know, in a almost random fashion. And I just wondered whether, you know, when you're doing those scenes, whether they speak to you personally, the idea of watching the audience, watching your film, and what they take from it.
Exactly, because, I mean, the thing is, like, you can see the same thing from two different points, and maybe one is going to see blue, the other one is going to see red. And in that moment, that film, it was done to provoke the audience. And for him, the religion, it was something that it was very intense on his life. Even he was saying for himself that he was agnostic. But if you see all the films of Buñuel, religion is something really, really important, because it was in his background, in his life, in his childhood. And people must be reading that. Certain people must be reading that in one way. Other people must be reading that in another way. That's why you can see there is comments of fascists and there is comments of communists. Because, I mean, it's really important. That's not the point. That's actually, he didn't want to. He was always playing with the maybe being communist, maybe not being communist. He was never actually, he was more worried about making react the audience. I mean, make the audience question things. No, I mean that. I mean, people at that time they were used to. I mean, I would say maybe at this time we are also somehow used to assume things. No, that this is true, or okay, we have to believe it. And in that time, what Buñuel was saying, okay, just make yourself questions. Don't assume that anything is like they are telling you. Just make the audience thought. And that was, at the end, what all his films, they do. I mean, they make the audience think. There is, you see, there is in his movies, there is always something that it's kind of like questioning you, and why is that? And that's maybe a metaphor, or that's me. And then somehow that drives you to the movie. No, it's you, then you start to analyze the movie, and then you start to think, and then you're going to question the society, you're going to question many things, and then you can have any opinion that you want. But what is important is that you actually think. You don't just, okay, they told me this, so it's like this. No, just question things and then make your own decisions.
Salvador, thank you very much. That's a lovely note to end on. Congratulations on the film. It's available now on BFI Player. And I know that you're a visitor to the BFI when you're over here. I know, yeah, it has a place in your heart. And so we look forward to being back in there as soon as possible. Thank you very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Mark. It was a pleasure for me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My thanks to Salvador Simo. If you'd like to see a video of that interview, then go to YouTube and check out the BFI channel on YouTube, or just search MK3D. There are a selection of shows up there. Now, it's with great pleasure that I welcome my next guest, picking a particularly brilliant guilty pleasure, the great Brian Cox. So, Brian, welcome to the show. Lovely to have you on this, albeit virtually. Tell me where you are, because at the moment your backdrop looks like you're either in space or in the Highlands.
No, I'm not in the Highlands. I'm in upstate New York. This is my backdrop. I don't know why. I can't. I'm sure I could switch it off, but I haven't got my glasses, so I can't see. But it actually looks quite nice.
Does. It's very picturesque. Right. And you're in upstate New York. Yeah.
I was in London and directing a play with my wife. And then, because I sort of go between London and the States. And then I came back to find that New York was in a pretty dire situation. So we hopped in the car, and luckily enough, we have this lovely house up in the country, which we don't get a chance to visit very often, but we actually got a chance to visit it now. And we've been here since March the 13th.
And how are you managing? How's lockdown?
It's okay. I mean, it's very good. It's lovely to watch the seasons. I mean, I'm surrounded by forest, so when I came here, there was not a leaf on a tree. But just watching everything come to fruition, and there was a bear seen just down the road from where we are today.
Yeah.
And so there are black bears all kinds of wildlife here. Deer, of course. You have to watch the ticks because of the Lyme disease. But it's really rather beautiful. It's really rather stunning. And it's actually a glorious day today. It's absolutely glorious. So, it's tougher on our boys. You know, we have a boy who's 18, two boys. We have one who's 15 and one who's 18. Now, our 18-year-old should be graduating, but unfortunately, he won't be. There'll be a virtual graduation, and he's actually he's at the Frank Sinatra School of the Performing Arts. So he's actually rehearsing a play at the moment, which he may or may not do, which is a great shame. But he's got himself into Brooklyn College, which is a great, he's doing anthropology and drama, which is a wonderful two-course thing that they do. It's a great school, Brooklyn College, and it's actually a public school kind of school. Public, yeah. In the sense of...
In the American sense of public, meaning public, as opposed to the UK sense in which public means private. Well, exactly. Yeah.
So that's been good. And then our youngest is doing online schooling, and he's a gamer, so he's on the whatnot all the time, you know. So that is a little bit tricky, and to say the least. But on the whole, he's it's tough. My wife thrives. She does yoga classes. She does three yoga classes, Kundalini yoga classes a week. So she does that, and she gets something like about 50 people, you know, who come in from. She does it on Facebook and Instagram, and she's a very good teacher. So she does that, and lots. And then we've been doing all kinds of things like this. I've been doing poetry. I did a virtual film. Which was a first, I think, where we filmed in six countries, three countries, here, London, and Denmark. We did a virtual film produced by Maggie Monteith, and we had three wonderful female directors who directed it, and it had Claes Bang in it. So it was a really interesting, because it was called the Agoraphobic Detective Society.
Was that, I presume that was put together as a result of lockdown happening? Yeah. It wasn't something...
I mean, there's a lot of extraordinary things happening in lockdown. There's a lot of... there's a wonderful writer called Richard Nelson who's been doing these plays called the Apple Plays, which came to Britain briefly and played in Brighton, I believe. And they're wonderful plays. And they're really about present history. You know, he started with 9/11. And they're kind of sort of a fairly democratic family. And he just did this one called Things We Talk About, which was about the lockdown. And it was sensational. And again, it was done from the public theatre, but it had about 35,000 viewers, which is quite amazing.
So you're managing to stay really productive by the sound of it, because there are some people...
Mark, I am more busy. I'm dying to get back to work, to be honest with you, so I can go and sit in my trailer for 5 minutes. No, it's been, you know, people say, could you do this? Can you do that? We did a gala the other night for Mums Against Poverty. We did that. We've done all kinds of things. And my wife and I both suffer from the same disease. We can't say no. It's no isn't a word that, apparently it's my Irish ancestry, because the Irish never say no. They'll say, ah, well, ah, sure, ah, but, you know, but never no. And so I'm caught with that.
That makes me worry that's how we persuaded you to come to the Shetland Film Festival. In that case,
I would have no problem at all. That is not. Well, you mustn't be worried about that at all. And also, what we're about to talk about is my guilty secret, and I love my guilty secret.
Yeah. So this is the moment in which I ask, you know, somebody to choose, and there's been a lot of discussion about whether there is such a thing as a guilty pleasure, because most people say, look, I'm not guilty about it.
I'm not guilty. Except
your choice. Your choice is great.
No, sorry, I was going to say, except that other people go, really? you know, but I'm not guilty.
Okay. So what is your guilty pleasure choice, Brian?
My guilty pleasure choice, and I actually worked out why it was The Court Jester by Frank and Panama. Melvin Frank and Norman Panama, who were great, great directors, wonderful comic directors. And it's a sensational script, very funny. And Danny Kaye, who is, I have a huge, huge, I mean, Walter Mitty, you know, did a remake of it, was totally awful with Ben Stiller, but, you know, the original is just fantastically brilliant. And, you know, he's just, he has this elegance and this zaniness at the same time. I just love Danny Kaye. And in this film, you see him at his best. You see him in all his range as a dancer, as a comic, as a singer, you know, and also nice songs. And his wife, Sylvia Fine, wrote the lyrics for a lot of his songs. I think it's Sammy Khan who actually writes the music in this. So it's a joyous film. And it's a film that I put on whenever I'm feeling low and I want a good laugh. I always put on the court jester. And then I realized the other day, it just occurred to me the other day, you know, my dad died at the beginning of 1955, and I was a sad wee boy for a long time. And this film came out in 1955. So I think that this may have been the first film that I suddenly enjoyed again after
after the
death of my father.
So they sent for a witch with a terrible twitch to ask how my future impressed her. She took one look at me and cried, what else could he be but a jester? A jester? A jester? A funny idea, a jester. No butcher, no baker, no candlestick maker, and me with the look of a fine undertaker impressed her as a jester. But where could I learn any?
So you have a sort of a restorative memory of it. You have a, you have an experience of it as being a film that, that restored your spirit.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the sequences are just, I mean, you asked me to pick some sequences. I mean, I could have gone on. There's so many sequences I could have picked. You know, I'm spoiled for choice on that one. And I just, it's just a delight. It's just a delightful film. And there's great performances like Cecil Parker as King Roderick. It's just, I just love Cecil Parker. He makes me laugh. Danny, of course, Clintus Johns, Basil Rathbone doing Basil Rathbone. And then also there is some of also the worst acting as well, which is from some of the extras playing rather in their tights with no legs at all, looking kind of just strange. You know, I've kind of got the odd line here and there, and you go, really?
Now, just if for the possibility that somebody hasn't seen it, I remember seeing it when I was a kid, but I must have seen it on television. And I've seen it a few times because I realized, you know, when they were doing you know, the thing with the poison was in the vessel with the pestle and all that. Okay, fine. So I know, you know, so I thought, okay, so I must have seen this. So it must have been on television a few times when I was young. But for anyone who hasn't seen it, what's the basic setup of the court jester?
Well, the basic setup is it's set at a sort of fictitious time. There's this usurping king called Roderick, who never existed. And I think it's all filmed in California, actually. It looks sort of looks like roughly like Cornwall, but I think it's California. And there's this infant who is the real heir to the throne. Glynis Johns and Danny has to dress as this, he dresses this kind of old man, and they're trying to smuggle the child across this particular area. And they get stopped by the king's men, and they get he's okay, but the girl gets taken. But on the way, they meet this character called Giacomo, who is about to be the king's jester, and he's played by John Carradine. So you've got these wonderful, you know, John Carradine, wonderful actor. So John Carradine's there and flamboyant, and plays this Giacomo, who's supposed to go off, and he's now the new jester to the king. So Glynis knocks him out and says, "You can pretend to be Giacomo." And of course, Danny, being a habitual coward, goes, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa," you know, and sort of starts to fall apart. He said, "No, you'll be fine, you'll be fine." But then she gets taken and they get separated. So he has to go, and there's a song that he has to sing, which is, I can't do it. Then the guy who's the contact, who's called Fergus, he gets in between these knights played by Basil Rathbone, gets in between him, and it's mistaken identity. So he thinks, oh, these are the guys that I've got to deal with, not the real guy. And they think, oh, this is the jester, who's actually an assassin as well, which he doesn't know about. So it all goes from there. And then there's Angela Lansbury, who plays she plays the king's daughter and takes it. And then there's wonderful, wonderful Mildred Natwick, or Mildred Dunnick. Mildred Natwick, I think, not Dunnick. There's always two Mildreds. I was getting confused. I think it's Mildred Natwick. And she plays Griselda, the kind of witch, and who eventually hypnotizes Danny to do certain things that Danny can't do, like fence. So, and that happens on the snap of her fingers. Like, so he fences, and if anybody snaps a finger, he loses control and then snaps back and he's back. And of course, there's a lot of this quick fire and wonderful, wonderful Panama Frank. I mean, they're just amazing. And then eventually, he has to through a long series of circumstances, she's the Griselda, who is the young princess's sort of handmaiden or kind of mother figure or something, you know. She says, you've got to tell me, you know, I've got to meet the person I love. I don't know the person I love. And so Danny appears and she points to him and she said, that's the guy. And he goes, oh, okay. And she starts falling with him. And then he, of course, isn't aware of all this and then gets involved. And then he gets challenged. So Griswold of McElwain arrives from the north, challenges Danny. So he has to go through this amazing sequence when he gets knighted, which is, again, incredibly comic. And then what happens is that, he's knighted. And then we have the famous scene where, and it's so brilliant. There's two gags that go on at the same time. There's the pellet with the poisons and the vessel with the pestle, and the chalice with the palace is the brood. It is true. And it starts off with the pellet with the poisons and the flagon with the dragon. Well, they break the flagon with the dragon, so they have to switch it to the chalice with the palace. And of course, this is Griselda, and he's got to memorize all this. In the meantime, lightning strikes his armor. And his armor becomes magnetic. So while he's doing this, his bits of metal are flying off him. And it's just a joy. It's an absolute joy of a movie.
The knights will approach each other.
Pellet with the poisons and the flagel with the chalice.
Poisons and the dragon with the pestle.
The chazzle is in the poisley with the plellus with the flam the flagless.
The pellet with the dragons and the pestle with the poison.
The pestle with the poison is the plazzle with the sleeveless. The poisley with the plazzle is the plazzle with the floors. The chalice with the flagon with the chalice. The poison with the flagon is the chalice with the poison.
The knights will face the king.
The palace with the chalice. The poison with the chalice is the chalice.
They will approach the royal pavilion.
One of the things that people forget about it is that it was a flop when it opened. I mean, it cost something like $4 million and it took two. And now it's on the National Registry. Now it is kind of accepted as a classic. But when it first opened, it was very, very expensive. And it failed at the box office. Is part of the charm of the film, and you talk about it as a guilty pleasure, is part of the charm the fact that it wasn't a hit, but then people found it for themselves? Yeah. I mean, I love your story about it having a very personal meaning for you.
Well, I think that was, I mean, I didn't know. I mean, as a, I would have been, yeah, my dad died when I was 8, but he died in March when I was, this is the first time I've heard that it didn't make any money, you know, but I think it's a classic. I really do think it's a classic.
And so you chose a number of sequences that many of which you've just waltzed us through, particularly the fantastic. But anything else that particularly stands out for you? Other than, I mean, from my point of view, I think the thing that's most remarkable about it is what I love about Danny Kaye is I'm a big fan of physical acting and song and dance and slapstick, which I think gets very much looked down upon now, particularly critically. And if you go back to the trailer for The Court Jester, one of the things that the trailer says is it shows you Danny Kaye doing all the things that you thought he couldn't do, the full range of his. And actually, it is an extraordinary performance. It's a physical performance. It's a musical performance. It's the full range.
And it's also, and it's surprisingly full of bathos, you know, because of he doesn't feel that he's up to much as a person. He just feels that he's, you know, because he's just this guy who reveals the baby's bottom, you know, and it looks after the baby. And of course, there's you realize there are bits of other films that have been thrown in, like that whole end sequence is very like the end sequence in Robin Hood. You know, it's very, very similar to when Robin comes in to meet King John and Sir Guy of Gisborne or the Sheriff of Nottingham. You know, it's very similar to the standoff with, and of course, you know, it does help that you've got Basil Rathbone in both situations.
Have you seen it regularly? Is it something that you just kind of go back
to? Well,
I
saw it the other night. I watched it again, and I watched it with my wife, and it was just compulsive. You start and you go, this is a silly film. And once you accept its silliness, it's a delight. And they play it to the hilt. You know, they don't apologize for it. They just do it. And
but that stuff is, I mean, that's pure Marx Brothers to me. That's absolute, you know, quick fire, you know, gibberish.
That's right.
In a way which is really, really hard to do.
No, I mean, I realized this the other night. I was looking at the date and I thought, 1955. And I realized why I had such a connection with the film, because it was a pretty black year for me that year.
Yeah,
and I just thought, wow. That was there, and I saw it. And I know the cinema I saw it. It was the Royal I saw it, which was in my hometown. There used to be 21 cinemas in my hometown, and the Broadway and the Royal, which were my cinemas, literally kitty corner to one another. Broadway was here, the Royal was here, and in my church, my Catholic church was there. The library was there. There was the Broadway, and on the other side of the street was the Royal. And then this big iron foundry where I used to play. It was where I played as a kid. And of course, it was double features. And it was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, change program, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And you saw as many as 8 films in a week. And I went, I saw them all.
Yeah.
from the age of about 6, you know, I was constantly going to the pictures.
Welcome, Giacomo. We have come to escort you to the castle. Haven't we met before?
It's not very likely, my good man. You see, I'm on my way back from the Italian court.
How speak you the king's English with no trace of accent?
My dear sir, Giacomo is the master of many, many tongues indeed. French? Je le dois ronsauteur, je le parle sauteur de plein, le fleur, je le patin sont romantiques. Je le passe toi, mais romantique, je le patois. Italian. Porto le vende, le sorto le basta. Alla forza le vonde, le sende le barda. Malte, le forza le vonda. German.
Was haben Sie ausgehalten, das Kneipe zu haben? Das Schmerzen wie die Hölle, Knöllschmerzen, das Kneipe zu haben? Haben Sie geflogen, die Helmen falsch gehalten? Hast du geflogen, das Meister, die Knöll wie die Hölle?
Which means in any language, why tarry? Let us off to the castle.
Off to the castle?
Off to the castle.
Do you have any thoughts about us all getting back into cinemas anytime in the near future?
I think that it's a complicated question, Mark, because I do think that the cinema has lost its way. I don't mean in terms of the making of the films. They're great. It's in the presentation of the films. I mean, I think the cinemaplexes are sort of like cattle things, you know. They haven't got the same... You know, when I was a boy, you went to the cinema and there was something special about it. There was something special about you. There was the wonderful Kiora lady who had a little tray of ice creams and pop and orange juice and stuff. And all of that, you know, all of that, that whole wonderful way. I mean, they're trying to get back to that now with some, you know, where they get, there's a group of cinemas in New York called the Alamo Cinemas, you know, where people run around and said, what do you want? You want a hamburger? what do you want? I mean, they're sort of running past you as you're trying to watch the movie. And it's quite comical, really, but they haven't quite got it right. But I just think that we've got to a point now where the audience itself is treated slightly contemptuously. You know, and I want to get back to a cinema that is more embracing of the whole experience. I mean, you see it when you go to great cinemas like that wonderful cinema in Notting Hill, you know, which I've been to see several stuff in. And, you know, you know it can be done. And if you're going to do small, but do it on a scale which isn't sort of, what's the word, you know, like churning it out, you know.
Yeah. But do you think that people are going to, I mean, whether the cinemas are multiplex chains or the kind of thing that you're talking about, I mean, one of my favorite cinemas is the Phoenix in East Finchley or the Plaza in Truro. But do you, But do you think that audiences are going to want to go back into cinemas because of everything that's happened?
Well,
we've all become so terrified of being around other people. We're all in isolation.
I think there are a few people who, of course, are expressing the opposite of that. They are feeling, they're rightly feeling, and though I disagree with them, because at this time we do have to exercise social distance, but it's not going to last forever. We will move to another plane. But I think that the lesson to be learned now is to how we embrace that new plane and what we take from this experience to that new experience of, and particularly in the community art form, theater and everything else. It's interesting that television has so much stolen a march on everything. The streaming services have stolen a march. And one of the great things about television is the kind of the form of the long form of writing, where you can develop something over a... So I'm watching a lot of great stuff at the moment, like there's a thing called The French Village, which is a whole thing about Vichy France, which is fascinating. There's a lot of stuff coming from Europe. There's a show called Rita from Denmark. And so you're getting a lot of people, and people are watching these shows. That's the other thing. People are going. There's a sort of hunger because people love to be entertained. I mean, I've got friends of mine who never, ever normally watch television. And suddenly, in this situation, they look forward to their evening. They watch it on their, they didn't have a television, they watch it on their computer. But it's become a ritual for them that in the night, that's what they do. They watch, husband and wife, they sit and they watch it now. And I do think that there is something, that's the magical aspect of the cinema for me, was that darkened room, the lights going down, then watching a double feature, going in at 6 o'clock in the evening and you got out at 11 because it was double feature.
Yeah.
And then you rush to beat the Queen. Because they used to play the national anthem. And we used to say, come on, let's get the hell out of here before they start doing that.
There's a famous episode of Dad's Army, which when they're all in the cinema and it ends with, they start the national anthem and Captain Mannering stands up and everyone just goes bang and they all just run over him and then he comes out the hat's all on sideways. Let me ask you one last thing. This is slightly off topic, but you're there, you're in upstate New York, and you're a well-traveled person, Brian, and you're somebody whose political opinions have often been very vociferous. I wonder if you would like to offer a comment on how the American presidency is currently handling everything.
He's taken this drug now, which everybody said is very, very dangerous. And whether he's taken it or not, whether he's lying, I mean, he's a kind of, it's pathetic. I mean, the man is pathetic. I mean, he's lying. He's, I don't know how anybody can believe him anymore. And he's clearly lost the plot. I mean, just the way he's behaving. And even his language, he sometimes loses things. He goes, blah, 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 blah. He literally goes like that now. So I think dementia is looming, which will be a blessing in disguise in this case. But it's just, you see, in a country this size where you need some sense of unity, you need some sense, there are Cuomo's done a great job here in New York. And in fact, I'm in an area now where it's very, very, there's very few, they're in the single figures, the amount of COVID inflicted people. And I think that, the fact that this notion of civil rights, which I find that people do not understand what civil rights mean. They think it's my rights, but no, it's the rights about the civil public. For we have to be cognizant of one another. That's what it's there for. That's why it's civil rights. It's not a selfish idea. I mean, one of the great problems of the American Constitution, I think, is this idea of, and it's in the Constitution, the pursuit of happiness. What does that mean? And when you get somebody like Trump, who behaves towards a kind of the notion of what America is, but it's not real. It's just not real. It's a fantasy, And he lives a kind of in a fantasy world, and of course he's such a liar. And I feel a little bit because he's, you know, he's half Scots. You know, his mother came from the Western Isles. And of course, there's very little said about his mother. And there's a lot said about Fred Trump, you know, who sounds like a real piece of work. But I just think he's lost the plot. I mean, I think he really has lost the plot. And it's just, it's ridiculous to see on a daily basis. You know, and of course, the media, you know, the Jimmy Kimmels and Stephen Colbert's, bless him, Bill Maher, you know, all those guys, they just go, this guy's an idiot. What are we doing? Why are we listening to him? You know,
there was a lovely interview some years ago with the great Scottish filmmaker Bill Forsyth, who said that if he ever wrote a character as two-dimensional as Trump, nobody would believe him.
That's right.
He said the problem is, it's like if you write a villain, they have to have something about them that's redeeming. But he said, you look at Trump, it's like a pantomime version of a villain. Right. There isn't anything else there other than malice and lying.
Yeah, and it would be a lousy part to play.
So if it's not a role that you would take on.
No, I would say this is, it's not good enough. It's two dimensional.
So Brian, when, you know, when it's possible to get back to work, what are you doing next?
To be doing the third season of Succession.
Which is going fantastically incredibly successful.
Yeah, incredibly well, you know. And, you know, it's all written. Jesse's done, the writer's room is in London, actually. Jesse's done, he's a bit of a genius, as Jesse Armstrong, so he's got it all there. We've had a couple of Zoom meetings with everybody. I think we probably have some more coming up. I mean, I don't know when we'll go. I'm not allowed to say when we'll go because nobody knows when we'll go. You know, but I mean, there are all kinds of measures being brought in order, because actually the thing is, they need product. You know, they haven't got stuff. You know, people are running. People are seeing stuff at an enormous rate. So, you know, they are ready for us to go back. But when is a big question.
And you've got the Ian Rankin adaptation coming up. When's that going to happen?
I did that. That's done. That's delivered.
It's all finished.
Yeah, it was just a little piece of Rebus in... it's called Detention. It's Rebus in lockdown, you know, and how he's dealing with it, you know, and not very well, as it happened.
It is astonishing, Brian, how productive you, not just how productive you are now, but how productive you have managed to be throughout. I was looking back, I mean, you and I have met and talked several times, and every time I meet you, there's been 15 things that you did since the last time we spoke. And if anything, you seem to get, but you just said in lockdown, you're busier than you've ever been before. There's a part of me that thinks that you have a workaholic gene, that you actually, you wouldn't be happy if you weren't.
I love my job. You know, I really love my job, Mark, you know, and I feel very blessed. And I feel that, you know, after being, I mean, next year in 2021, touch wood, if I'm still here, I will have been in the business for 60 years, since I was 15. So I've experienced the whole gamut of it over 60 years of how it's, you know, and the great period, of course, still for me, the great period is the 60s. Because to be living in the UK, that, you know, and we haven't got that anymore, was that sense of social mobility, which was so phenomenal. And also somebody like me, you know, with a widowed mother, I got a grant. I got expenses. I mean, I did very well going to drama. And I went to a drama school. And I was taken care of. And those were tighter times than we have now. You know, and the way we treat people, you know, the way we treat our citizens is just not acceptable. You know, that's why I've kind of gone, you know, I was never, I don't like the word nationalist. I've never liked the word nationalist, but I have become more and more a Scottish independent, more and more, you know, because I also think that Nicola does a great job. I look at her and I think she talks sense. Whenever she talks, she talks sense. And I think a lot of people are impressed by her. But
well, when you were in Shetland, you were there sort of actively campaigning for the SNP and talking about those issues back then, however many years ago it was back then. Yeah. And actually, I think, if anything, I think that certainly Nicola Sturgeon's reputation over the last few years has, if anything, increased not least because of the chaos of what's happening in the rest of the bloody country.
Well, exactly. You see, and I do think that, you know, I mean, as we say in Scotland, the current prime minister is such a balloon, you know, and he doesn't learn anything, you know.
What does it explain that expression, Brian? I've never heard that. Balloon. Such a balloon.
Yeah, he's a balloon.
Yeah, was it?
It's a very Scottish one. Oh, the man's a balloon. And, you know, and he is. You know, and you think, this is a man who was near death. Did you not learn anything? You know, did no penny drop? And he's overriding ambition also precludes every kind of, you know, this man is not going to have a Damascus moment. And yet he's been given something. You go, didn't you know? Didn't you get it?
So, Brian, if next year is your, are you doing something for your 60 years in showbiz?
Well, I'll wait till I get there and see. Well, I'm diabetic, so I'm one of the high risk people. So I can't be too smug about it. You know, I'm in a very good situation here. But
yeah, you look in very good health, Brian. So I am going to take this opportunity to invite you next year when all this is behind us, and hopefully you have another president in America, and whoever knows what's happening here, to come to the NFT, to the BFI South Bank, and we will do a celebration of 60 years of Brian Cox's theatrical and cinematic career. Oh. And I would like to invite you to do that now, because I think it's going to be great.
Okay.
I mean, it'll go on for hours. I mean, you know, it would be like 4 days or something, but please, you know, come and let's do it. Let's do a sort of proper celebration of it. Yeah?
That's great, Mark. Thank you so much.
My thanks to Brian Cox and Salvador Simo. If you want to see video versions of those interviews, albeit in cut-down forms, then go to YouTube, search for the BFI channel, or just search MK3D. If you've enjoyed this podcast and other Kermode on Film podcasts, then remember to subscribe and tell your friends. Also, check out our Patreon page, where there's loads of extras, including exclusive video content. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. Keep watching the skies.